once again, this is Dr. Phil Fernandez, the founder of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the academic dean of Fariston Theological Seminary. Today's lecture is Apologetics Lecture Number 11. Apologetics Lecture Number 11. Today's discussion will be on moral values. Moral values. As we discuss moral values, what we need to look at first is moral relativism. Moral relativism. Moral relativism is basically the anti-Christian belief that there really is no such thing as right and wrong, that each person decides what is right for himself. So each person deciding what is right for himself is the view of the moral relativist. Now, there's certain people we want to look at. Friedrich Nietzsche lived from 1844 to 1900, was a German philosopher. At that point, he had believed that he and many other atheists of his time believed that the evidence was so overwhelming that the God of the Bible does not exist. He believed that the evidence was so overwhelming that therefore religion was dead. In other words, he coined the phrase, God is dead. And what he meant by that is that God did not create man, but man created God by his imagination. And that once man grew up philosophically and became a mature atheist, then man's idea of God died. And since God is dead, then all traditional values have died with him. Nietzsche said, what we need is a breed of supermen, a group of supermen who could rise above the situations of their life. A group of supermen who should come along and create their own values with their will to power. They should have a strong will or strong desire to power. That these men should boldly go where no men have gone before and should create their own values with their will to power. Nietzsche did not like what he referred to as the soft values of Christianity. He recommended some hard values. There's a lot of discussion about what exactly he meant there. But he said, if God is dead, if God has been proven to not exist, then the traditional values taught in the Bible died with them, and therefore we need an intellectually elite group of men, supermen, who should create their own values with their will to power. You see, Friedrich Nietzsche recognized what so many atheists have not recognized, and that is that without God, there are no universal moral laws. Without God, there are no universal moral values. In other words, if there's no God who is above man, who legislates what is right and what is wrong to man, then the highest moral beings we can turn to is man himself. So if there isn't a God who is qualitatively above man, then all you have is man alone as your reference point for morality. And so Nietzsche understood that each person decides for himself what is right if there is no God. And what he suggested was that there be a group of elite men who we call supermen that would create their own values and usher in a new age, a new time period. Now, Adolf Hitler read the writings of Nietzsche, and although Nietzsche spoke out when the Nazis began to come on the scene, this was before even Hitler's rise to power as their leader, Nietzsche spoke out. Of course, he died in 1900. He died well before even the First World War. But Nietzsche spoke out against hatred of Jews, and apparently he was against that. But I think what we need to recognize here is that Adolf Hitler and his view of the Aryan race as the master race, Adolf Hitler and company, the Nazis, believed that they could assume the role of Superman, assume the role as the master race, and that they could create their own values with their will to power. And they too did not like the soft values of Christianity. And so though Nietzsche would have disagreed with Hitler's application of Nietzsche's teachings, the fact remains the teachings that Nietzsche brought forth would give rise to someone like Hitler eventually. I mean, once you say there's no such thing as right and wrong, you got to invent your own values, then, you know, one guy might invent some nice values, but another guy's going to invent values that would say the best thing for us is for us to put Jews and my political enemies in ovens and cook them alive. And so Adolf Hitler was influenced by him. Now Nietzsche, even in his example, he gave the ancient Greek philosophers. But what we need to understand is that one of Aristotle's pupils was Alexander the Great. And from all his study of philosophy, Alexander the Great came to the conclusion that there's two kinds of people in the world. There's the Greeks and there's the barbarians. All non-Greeks were barbarians. You see, Alexander the Great had some type of, he was an intellectual, a philosopher himself, and he came up with some kind of master race type thinking to where the Greeks were the master race and everybody else was their barbarians. Alexander the Great viewed true freedom as the Greeks enslaving non-Greeks to do all their work for them, so that the Greeks could just sit around and party, debate philosophical issues, and be political leaders. And that was his idea of freedom. When Nietzsche used them as an example, Adolf Hitler is just a different application of the same basic principles that Alexander the Great was ruled by. And that is that his own people were some type of master race and everybody else is a barbarian, lesser than them. And to the extent that they don't serve our purposes, we should just get them out of the way. So there's Friedrich Nietzsche's basic teaching. Just remember this statement, if you forget everything else. He taught that if God is dead, then traditional values died with him, and we need supermen, a group of supermen who would create their own values with their will to power. He didn't like the way the Nazis did things, but what objective moral values could Nietzsche bring up to condemn the Nazis? You know, atheists are in the business of saying what's right for you is right for you, it doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. But then whenever somebody does something that they don't like, they resurrect a scriptural moral law to condemn the actions of the other person. You can't do that. You can't have it both ways. Either there is a God with his moral laws, or there is no God and there are no moral laws. And each man can decide for himself. You know, I once, when I spoke at Central Kitsap High School on creation science, one of the teachers, Mr. Turner, who was an atheist, got real upset with me, and he said, "One thing I don't like about you Christians, you teach that that atheists can't be moral." And I told him, I said, "I do not teach that." And he said, "Yes, you do. I heard you." And I said, "I did not teach that." And he said, "Yes, you did." And I said, "I did not. I never said that atheists can't be moral, but I said that an atheist can't be consistent with his view of atheism and be moral." In other words, when that atheist is helping fellow humans and is giving money to the poor and sheltering the sick, he's acting very inconsistent with his atheism. Because in his atheism, whether he took a butcher knife and killed an old lady, or whether he helped an old lady across the street, would make absolutely no difference whatsoever. There's no such thing as right and wrong if there is no God who stands above man and has determined what is right and what is wrong. That's Friedrich Nietzsche. And Bertrand Russell was a British philosopher and mathematician who lived from 1872 to 1970. Bertrand Russell, one of his most famous works is a compilation of his writings entitled Why I Am Not a Christian. Bertrand Russell. Now, he has stated this, and I quote, "Outside human desires, there is no moral standard. Outside human desires, there is no moral standard." In other words, moral standards are based on what man desires. Again, you end up with a system of moral relativism, where there's really no such thing as right and wrong objectively. Everything is subjective. What you desire is right or wrong. Now, he would, in his debate with Father Copleston on the existence of God, and the transcript of that debate is found in John Hicks' the Existence of God work. In that debate, he tried to call the actions of Hitler wrong there, and I believe he really failed. You know, if outside human desires there's no moral standard, what if a person desires to kill? What about Adolf Hitler? And that was brought up to him, and he tried to say, well, you know, some people are colorblind, and so just as I can see when the light turns red, some people can't tell when the traffic light turns red. And so some people are colorblind. In other words, some people's desires are messed up. But Father Copleston reminded him, some people's desires are good and some people's desires are bad, then desires do not judge, do not determine the moral values. You're appealing to a standard that is above a man's desires. In other words, if desires is the ultimate test of what is right and what is wrong, the human desires, then you can't appeal to something higher than those desires to judge whether an act was right or a desire was right or wrong. And Bertrand Russell really did not have a comeback for that. Father Copleston, the Jesuit priest, I thought did a real number on it. It was an argument over God's existence, but this issue came up. And the fact is that Bertrand Russell has no way to judge the desires of another person wrong unless he appeals to some moral authority which stands above human desires. Now, A.J. Ayer, who is very heavy into examining language in his philosophy, A.J. Ayer said that moral commands, such as if I said, thou shalt not kill, moral commands really just express one's subjective feelings. In other words, when Phil Fernandez says, thou shalt not kill, what he's really saying is, I subjectively or inwardly feel that killing is wrong. Now, when you examine those two statements, you see that in human experience, they are not synonymous. They are not saying the same thing. There are two totally different things that are being said here. One says, you shall not kill because killing is wrong. The other statement is, I don't think you should kill because I got this gut feeling that it's wrong. And those are two totally different things. So moral commands are not equal to the expression of one's subjective feelings. They're definitely worlds apart there. We use language to words as signs to represent the meaning that we're trying to get across. And if you look at Ayer, it seems to go against this because we're using signs to determine a certain meaning. And he's saying, no, they both mean the same thing. Well, then why are we using totally different signs and going through all this effort to get across two totally different meanings? And he says they're both the same meaning. And I think the evidence is stacked against him. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, the famous French existentialist, his view was that there's no objective meaning to life and that man must create his own values. Basic existentialist position, you know, there's no meaning to life, and therefore we need, but man so desperately needs meaning, so we have to take a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm to create meaning for our life. But Sartre says there's no objective meaning to life. Man must create his own values. Sartre went on to say that it really doesn't matter whether there's an old lady, whether you help an old lady crossing a street or whether you mug her. The important thing is you've actualized yourself. You've given meaning to your life. Now, Sartre did not live that way. Sartre stood up for what he thought was right. Though I disagree with him, he was a Marxist. But he stood up for what he was right. He took a stand against human rights violations and things like that. But see, he lived like there was objective meaning to life. And so he couldn't even live his own view out. I mean, if everybody lived like there's no such thing as right or wrong, and each person could do what's right in their own eyes, you know, we'd wipe each other out in a matter of years. All human life would cease to exist. You know, you'd have motorcycle gangs wiping people out, street gangs wiping people out, and you'd have basically respectable people eating and drinking for tomorrow we die. You know, it's just what the Apostle Paul said, 1 Corinthians 15. If the dead are not raised, if God isn't going to raise the dead, if there isn't going to be a future judgment, and if we die and then we cease to exist, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. If there's no such thing as right and wrong, why do each one of these individuals take such a firm stand for what they feel is right? It just doesn't make sense. And so an atheist can live a moral lifestyle, in speaking in man's terms. None of us can please God on our own. But an atheist can live a moral lifestyle, but he's not consistent with his belief system, because his belief system would say that he would do exactly what he desires. In fact, another thing is, too, is sometimes we do exactly what we don't desire. Sometimes Phil Fernandez desires to stay in bed and not go to work, but he gets up and he goes to work. Sometimes a man is walking on a bridge and he desires to go on living and not to jump in water that's well over his head, but he sees someone drowning, and so he jumps out. Now, some would say, well, maybe there's the desire to save a life outweighs it, or this or that. I think it's something else. I think what we've got there is the desire, what we feel like doing, running smack into a moral value which says what we ought to do. You see, there's a difference between what we feel like doing and what we ought to do. And each one of us has an idea within us of the concept of right and wrong, that we often disagree in how that applies to individual situations. Hedonism is the belief system that whatever brings pleasure is right. Hedonism is the belief that whatever brings pleasure is right. It's the idea that if it feels good, do it. If it feels good, do it. You know, surgery doesn't bring a whole lot of pleasure. Surgery can hurt. Yet at the same time, surgery is often the right thing to do and the best thing to do in order to save a life. But hedonism would say whatever brings pleasure is right. If it feels good, do it. That's the idea that Paul is getting at. If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Live it up now, because you ain't got much time. That type of thinking, that's hedonism. The Epicureans were the ones who actually started this view, although theirs wasn't as harsh a view as it is now. But the Greek philosophers, the Epicureans, in embryo form, started what eventually became full-blown hedonism. Then there's the view, utilitarianism. Utilitarianism, which says that what is right is the greatest good for the greatest number. What is right is the greatest good for the greatest number. There's a major problem with this view, and that is that the Marxist feels that the greatest good for the greatest number is to have a communist takeover of the globe. The capitalist feels that the greatest good for the greatest number is to have a free enterprise system where business can flourish and they can create good jobs for the public, and that the nation can prosper that way. You'll have the Christians believe the greatest good for the greatest number is if the world would submit to Christianity and if the gospel was spread and accepted worldwide, whereas the atheist believes the greatest good for the greatest number is for us to remove the superstitions such as atheism from our minds and recognize that when we die we cease to exist, and let's hold hands and try to make this the best that we can right now, and which their view of what the best is much different than the Christian. So the question comes up with utilitarianism, if the what is right is the greatest good for the greatest number, who's the one who's going to decide? Who's going to sit on the throne and say, I'm the all-knowing being, I'm the one who knows all the facts, and I'll tell you what the greatest number, the greatest good for the greatest number is. You know, some people think the greatest good for the greatest number is abortion and population control through euthanasia or whatever. You know, and different things. And very often there's a de-emphasis on the value of the individual as a being created in God's image. They devalue the human to where the good of the whole is so much more important, and it gets to the point where the value of an individual human life is downgraded. Then we have situation ethics, which was proposed by Joseph Fletcher, and he taught that ethics are relative to the situation. Ethics are relative to the situation. In other words, murder might be right at one time and wrong at another time. So the values aren't universal. Now, he says that love's decisions, Fletcher says that love's decisions are made situationally and not prescriptively. In other words, you don't go by what the Ten Commandments say. You just go by what the situation calls for, and you live by love. Now, his problem with his concept of love is an empty concept of love. It's a blank check. You fill it in when the situation comes up. The example he gives is a woman in a German concentration camp. And at this certain concentration camp, they were releasing pregnant women. And she wants to get home and visit her family and stuff, but she can't leave because she's not pregnant. And so what she does is she realizes that one of the guards is real attracted to her. And so she has sex with him, gets pregnant, gets released from the prison camp, and then goes home to be with her husband. He would say that that was the right thing to do because the love overrid any moral prescriptions, any moral laws. Now, the Christian response to this is this, and we have to think there's some hairs that need to be split. No true Christian should hold to situation ethics. However, some of the points he makes should be well taken. For instance, Christ told the Pharisees, Christ used to heal on the Sabbath when you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And so then Christ said, well, don't you guys circumcise if the 8th day falls on the Sabbath? In other words, the Bible says don't work on a Sabbath, rest on the Sabbath. But the Bible also says if a boy is 8 days old, you circumcise him. And Jesus says, well, if the 8th day falls on the Sabbath, you obey that greater law and you receive an exemption from the lesser law. But the Christian response is that the situation never determines what is right. God determines what is right. Still, the situation often helps us determine which of God's laws should be applied. Let me repeat that. The Christian response is this. The situation never determines what is right. It is God who determines what is right. Still, the situation often helps us determine which of God's laws should be applied. Now, some Christians, like John Warwick Montgomery, would say when two of God's moral laws conflict, you've got to obey the lesser evil, do the lesser evil, and then ask God for forgiveness. I would disagree with Montgomery on this point and agree with Dr. Norman Geisler, who teaches the greater good doctrine rather than the lesser evil. When two of God's commands come in conflict, because we live in a cursed creation, we are obligated to obey the greater good. And then the lesser good is not, it's not that that law is, there's an exception to that law. It's universal. There are no exceptions to it, but we receive an exemption from obeying it at that particular time. When you circumcise on the eighth day, you receive an exemption from resting on the Sabbath so that you may obey the greater law, which is circumcision. Rahab the harlot. Rahab the harlot lied, and it's wrong to lie, but she lied in order to save the lives of innocent, godly Jewish spies. So she received an exemption. Lying is always wrong, but she received an exemption because it is greater to save innocent human lives. It is a greater good to save innocent human lives than to tell the truth to evil men. It'd be the same if somebody holds you at gunpoint and asks you where your family is because they want to murder them. If you tell the truth there because you can do no wrong, you're actually doing much more wrong there. So it's not a case of doing the lesser evil. Jesus, when Jesus' mother asked him to do something about the wine that had run out at the wedding feast, Jesus said, hey, you know, my time hasn't come. But then what did he do? He ended up performing a miracle before his time. Why? Because it is good. It is good to start your ministry at the perfect time, but it is better to submit to your mother. It is better to be a good son. It is a greater good. And so there, in that, when those two issues, now if she had asked him to do something like destroy 500 innocent people, that'd be a whole different issue there. The Christian response, though, is the greater good. Situation never determines what is right. God determines what is right. We need to look into God's word to see where the higher priorities are. Our relationship with God is of greater importance than our relationship with fellow man. Our relationship with our family, we have more responsibility to take care of our family than we do somebody 3,000 miles away. Yet, if God has prospered us, maybe we should also take care of that person if that person can't take care of themselves. But there's a priority of God's laws, a hierarchy of God's laws, and we need to recognize that. Jesus told Pontius Pilate that he was not, that the one who betrayed him, Judas, was guilty of a greater sin than Pontius Pilate. There's a hierarchy in God's commands. There are some sins that are worse than others, and there are some acts that are better than others. And so there's a hierarchy. So there'll be rewards for those who have served the Lord with their lives, at different degrees of rewards in heaven, different degrees of punishment in hell. And I think that Geisler's greater good doctrine is correct. I don't think Rahab the harlot, who's complimented throughout the scriptures for lying to save innocent lives, I don't think she ever had to confess her sin because she did the lesser evil. God compliments her for what she did, and so she chose to do the greater good. So that's moral relativism, the belief that each person decides what is right for himself. What's right for me is right for me, doesn't have to be right for you, and vice versa. The system just does not work. We're going to look right now at the problem with moral relativism. You see, when one denies God's absolute moral law, yet, you know, if a person denies God's absolute moral law, if he then calls evil, if he proclaims another person to be evil, in other words, if evil in another person is proclaimed like Hitler, somebody says, hey, that guy's evil, then some type of absolute standard must be resurrected in order to make the value judgment. Once we say there's really no such, we can't be certain about what's right and what's wrong, there's no such thing as right and wrong, each person decides himself. But once we call Adolf Hitler or anybody else evil, we're resurrecting some absolute standard. We're referring to some standard which is above all men. A book by Dr. Erickson, professor at Olympic College in Bremerton, Theologians Under Hitler, he comes right out and says, Hitler was evil, therefore to follow him is wrong. But then when you read his book, you find that he holds to a view of a type of moral relativism, that we need to take existential leaps in life and that we can't be sure what is right, what is wrong. We can't find certainty in moral values, this and that, we must take an existential leap, but this existential leap is neutral in terms of morality. Well, there's some definite problems with this, because once you proclaim that another person is evil, you're appealing to an absolute standard in order to make the moral value judgment. It's inconsistent. I saw a television debate between a rabbi and a homosexual. And the homosexual asked the rabbi, why do you think homosexuality is wrong? He said, because it's a sin. It's a sin. And the homosexual says, you can't say that. You're making a moral value judgment. And you know, so many people today accept that you can't make moral value judgment. Well, when the state says, thou shalt not kill, they're making a moral value judgment. The state has no right to throw people in prison or to execute them if they kill somebody if we can't make moral value judgments. But when the homosexual says, you can't say that, you're making a moral value judgment, the rabbi just smiled. A couple minutes later, he started reading an article about some homosexual who wants the right to teach in public schools, and he thinks that he should have the right to have sex with consenting juniors and seniors in high school. He should be able to have sex with his male students that he feels like. The other homosexual says, well, I disagree with that. And so the rabbi looked at him and said, well, why do you disagree with that? And he said, because I think it's wrong. The homosexual said, because I think it's wrong. And the rabbi smiled and said, but you can't say that. You're making a moral value judgment. And so the homosexual says, you can't call my actions wrong, but I can call the actions of another homosexual wrong. Everybody condemns the actions of somebody at some time. We all recognize evil actions when we are wronged. You might say there's no such thing as right and wrong, but then if I punched you in the nose, you'd either hit me back or you'd call the cops. We all recognize evil actions when we're wronged. That's why Christ's statement in Matthew 7:12 is so profound. Do to others what you would have them do to you. Christ didn't say do to others what you think is right, because then we treat everybody horrible. But Christ said, do to others the way you want to be. Treat others the way you want to be treated. Because whenever we're always looking out for number one, when we think about how we want to be treated, we're going to treat others better. Now what we need to talk about is the absolute moral law. What is the absolute moral law? I'm going to use Dr. Norman Geisler and Paul D. Feinberg's definition from Introduction to Philosophy. Their definition of the absolute moral law is, by a universal right is meant a duty that is binding on all men at all times and in all places. Now remember, though it's binding on all men at all times and in all places, if it comes in conflict with a moral, absolute moral law that comes above it, that is greater than it, you would receive an exemption from it. It's not an exception to it. There are no exceptions, but you would receive an exemption from it. So the absolute moral law, by a universal right, is meant a duty that is binding on all men at all times and in all places. Now the Bible declares God's absolute moral law. The moral law is not above God, because nothing is above God. If the moral law was above God, then the moral law would be God, and God would be a lesser God. God wouldn't be the true God. Nothing is above God. So the moral law is not above God. At the same time, the moral law is not arbitrary. God didn't say, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Okay, the eenies and meenies are good, and the minies and mo's are bad. It's not arbitrary. Now, how do we reconcile the two? The moral law flows naturally from God's good nature. In other words, the moral law is not a standard above God, nor is it an arbitrary standard, but God is the standard. It's God's nature determines what is right and what is wrong. You see, God is only subject to his own good nature. God is only subject to his own good nature. By saying that God is all-powerful and God is infinite, God is unlimited, we mean that God is not limited by anything outside of himself. There are some limitations on God, such as God cannot fail, God cannot sin, God cannot make mistakes, God cannot change his mind, God cannot create something that could overpower him. So God is only subject to his own good nature. God is the standard. The standard is not above God, nor is the standard arbitrary. I'd like to close with a real brief argument for the absolute moral law. Brief argument for the absolute moral law. First, I'll read from Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15 to show that the Bible teaches that each person, even if you're a non-Jew or if you never read the Bible, you never heard of God's law, God's Ten Commandments or his laws in the Bible, you have an idea written in your conscience of what is right and what is wrong. Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. And so the Gentiles, when they live like something is right and something is wrong, and again, we all admit that something is wrong when we're wrong, they show that they've got an idea, some concept of right and wrong in their conscience. We all sear our consciences and often do ruthless things, but even Adolf Hitler had a concept of right and wrong. I mean, he thought it was right and good and the best thing for his society to kill his political enemies. And although we would disagree and say he was wrong, he was horribly cruel, he was vicious, he was evil, even we have to still admit, even he had some concept of what is right and what is wrong. He thought to oppose him is wrong and to back him is right. But our argument for the absolute moral law would run as follows. The moral law, and we all admit there's a moral law there somewhere, whether each person is autonomous and they decide on their own, and by the way, the humanist manifestos teach that each man is, ethics are autonomous. In other words, each person is self-governed, each person determines what is right or what is wrong. Paragraph later, the humanist manifesto written by secular humanists who deny God's existence, a couple paragraphs later they're saying, but we're against all forms of sex that we're against any form of sex that isn't between two consenting adults. So what are they saying? We're against having sex with children, and we're against rape. Now, if you're a Christian, you can say we're against having sex with children and against rape. But if you just said that human values are autonomous, each person determines what is right on their own, then, you know, how can you condemn the actions of anyone else unless you resurrect values, traditional values, especially the values taught in the Bible? But the moral law doesn't come from within each individual, for then we could not call the actions of another person wrong. You couldn't call the actions of Hitler wrong if the moral law comes from with each individual, because hey, Hitler did what was right in his own eyes. If we each should do what's right in our own eyes, you can't condemn him. Secondly, the moral law just doesn't come from each society, because then one society can't call another society wrong. America wouldn't be able to call the Nazi Germany wrong. So it doesn't come from each society. Third, it doesn't come from a world consensus, because if the world consensus is split, then something would have to be both right and wrong at the same time, and that would violate the law of non-contradiction. Secondly, a world consensus is not infallible. Remember, the world consensus once said the world is flat. The world consensus once said that the sun revolves around the earth. So world consensus is not infallible. It makes mistakes. And third, a world consensus in society, it only adds men. It only adds men. You get more quantity, but you don't get a moral law that is qualitatively above man. You just add more and more quantity, more and more numbers. What we actually need is a moral law qualitatively above man. And a moral law that is qualitatively above man needs a moral law giver. You can't have a moral law, with an absolute moral law, which stands above man without an absolute moral lawgiver who stands above man. You see, the moral law is not a description of what is. Saying I should do good things is not the same as saying I do good things. It's not a description of the way things are. The moral law is prescriptive of what should be. I ought to do this and that. I ought not to do this and that. It prescribes what should or should not be, rather than describing the way things are. I mean, if the moral law was descriptive, then every atheist would have to look upon Adolf Hitler. Every person, every moral relativist who believes that moral law is descriptive, they would have to look upon Adolf Hitler and say, well, Adolf Hitler did this and that, and they describe it, and that's all they can do. But once they say that what he did was wrong, they're appealing to a moral law that stands above men. And the atheist, you know, the problem with, one of the main problems with atheism, on Monday they say there's no such thing as evil, because each one decides for himself what is right and wrong. No such thing as evil, because they know if they admit to an absolute standard of evil, you've got to admit to the absolute moral law, which means you've got to admit to the absolute moral lawgiver, which means you have to admit to God's existence. So on Monday, they deny the absolute moral law. But on Tuesday, they'll argue that God can't exist because of the existence of evil. So it depends what day you're talking to Bertrand Russell as to whether or not he's going to be talking about the absolute moral values or not. They're going to disguise their language, but they're going to be inconsistent. And if they don't want to be inconsistent, if they want their thinking to be straight, if they don't want to be inconsistent and constantly contradict themselves, then all they'd have to do is bend the knee to the God of the Bible, study the Word of God, and think the system through. Because that alone is the non-contradictory worldview, the Christian worldview, the belief in the God of the Bible. There is an absolute moral law. Moral relativism fails. There is an absolute moral law, and so therefore there must be an absolute moral lawgiver. And this absolute moral lawgiver is the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the triune God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Thank you, and God bless you.